The
Saturday Post.
He owned it.
Oh.
For 4 years against between 1900 1904.
He was a liberal against the privilege.
Oh, yes, very definitely.
It's a strange thing. That he should have made such ambitious plans for what was essentially a kind of summer resort, you know, or all year round resort, but for the rich. I don't understand it.
So his initial conception was entirely different than this.
He had a feeling about the upper classes.
Well, he at first went into business with the people who were going to develop Ocean Park. But his conception for Venice was a cultural center. And he broke with the people who developed Ocean Park because they did not agree. They were strictly businessmen. He began Venice for the first year only bringing in cultural people, writers, sculptors. At this time, of course, there was no money. It did not attract the public, and he was forced to, in order to make some money, to break even, he was forced to bring in some of this. But through the years, even up to the 40s, as far as we can determine, he was still responsible for bringing in.
Well, actually, until a few years after his death. Right, he died in 1920.
When he died, his brothers,
in 1920.
Yeah.
His children did not have the same feelings that he did about culture and art. And according to his daughter, there were concerts. The Italian concerts were going on until the 20s, till a year after.
And then his brothers took over, and that was
not his brothers, his children.
Or his sons.
I wonder how he felt about King Oliver out on the pier. Whether the pier was one of his, the amusement pier in the concert hall. You know, that was one of his projects. And it's a curious thing that while he probably regarded European music as culture, that this pier was probably the first hall on the West Coast where New Orleans jazz was heard.
Yes, his daughter mentioned this. In fact, he started many of the very well-known Ben Pollock.
Did
he have any part in that booking?
Supposedly he did, yes.
I'm not sure about that.
According to his
daughter. The only thing that I have learned about him, he really was devoted to the music, because I know he was involved with an opera company in Los Angeles and was responsible for the building of the Tivoli Opera House, which was built around the turn of the century.
He wanted his daughter to become an opera singer, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
Was it Melba whom he brought here to the Venice Pier?
He brought Sarah Bernhardt.
I thought he brought one of the operas.
Oh, he did.
He did, but not Melba.
Melba was before his time.
In 1903 or something.
Well, it didn't open till 5.
Mrs. Craig said that Melba sang here. And she remembers Bernhardt playing here, too.
Yes.
We had a landlady who was about 85 years old or something. This is some years back.
Yeah, many memories of
Venice. She had a lot of memories of Venice.
These people haven't been back in 10 years. They can't face it.
But they're incredible people. It's very... Oh, it's fantastic, this whole thing, because they had he was a veritable king and had his own grounds. He had 6-7 acres of lawn. The whole thing,
he had the ranch, he had the Kineola out in Sierra Madre.
This guy is a tremendous man, and his daughter has escaped. It's all kind of a dream, you know. She has not gone back to Venice. The legal problems, the scandals, she is all...
Yes, the family has some black sheep. I don't know which one of the brothers it was, but she didn't want to talk about it.
It's an incredible story. It should be written, actually.
No, Rink is the story I heard. One of the sons.
No doubt.
I didn't know what it was exactly.
Well, that's par for the course with the turn of the century billionaires.
Mrs. Craig used to talk about the sporting houses for a while, Larry, and I didn't know what she was talking about. I couldn't...
Sporting houses.
Yeah.
Other scandals connected with it and all that sort of thing. For a while, though, is it true, as I've heard, that for a while, people of wealth and social position did come to Venice and stay in these hotels?
I think very definitely. I know she spoke of them entertaining some president of the United States in their home. But of course, Kinney was related to George Washington, the descendant of Washington. He was brought up in the home of a United States senator. And I read in one book where he had translated something for Grant, for President Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in, he knew
spoke
the family.
Eight languages.
He knew the family of Lincoln.
Incredible.
And was involved in this type of society. And these, I think, for a period there, there were many people like this who did come to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then
did she say that
Al Capone was there in the 20s, different society.
Did she say that that he had seen old Venice?
Yeah. Oh, well, I read that. I read that in many places. One thing.
Yes, she did say
one
that.
One thing she brought up that was very interesting. But why it was Venice? When he had been in Venice, Italy, not only had he fallen in love with the architecture, but he had fallen in love with the Italian people and the singing, and he loved the gaiety and the happiness.
The Gondoliers.
Yeah, and this just charmed him.
The Neapolitan song probably enchanted him.
He liked the people, the temperament, really is what she's trying to say, the happiness, the apparent happiness, the outward show of these people, the vivacity of these people, and this is why he founded a Venice rather than, you know, many other parts of old Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And but this is a very interesting idea.
Of course, something else which I've read was that Venice was probably the most feasible because of the drainage to build the canals, because it was all swampland and
But of course, this wouldn't have entered into it. He could have done anything. It wasn't a question of that. But he was attracted to Venice like a magnet because of this.
In fact, he sent her to Europe as soon as she was out of
high school.
Sent her
to Europe right after high school.
Well, there were probably a number of different places along the beach where the swampy land there met with the ocean, and it went to suggest an old Venice, which is of course built on the sea, you know.
Yeah.
So he created an artificial island there by building canals around it. That's what you have there, to be approached only by bridges. And what else does she remember that you think I might find interesting?
Oh my goodness, I have so many pages of notes. Well, she talked about the history of the company and what had happened, but she really sketchy on details. She didn't want to.
He was really overwhelmed by merchants and the business civilization.
Oil, well, when they discovered oil down here.
This was later.
This was later.
The oil came later, and the oil did help to follow it up because it lowered real estate values. And not only that, but it seeped through into the canals, and the canals became followed up.
She blames the city of Los Angeles. The annexation
for
the
1925
for ruining the canals, because one of the stipulations was that the city of Los Angeles would keep the canals up, and they didn't.
Yeah.
And she blames the city for the deterioration all the way through.
Yeah.
She
is absolutely right. All of the people that I've talked to who remember old Venice say that troubles began with annexation. They call it the rape of Venice. They said it had been sold out. I suppose that it was advantageous to the businessmen to annex, because they had, I suppose they expected many favors from the council in the way of
That's exactly what she said.
Yeah.
Improvements
right.
and street improvements.
This is what I've read also.
They didn't get much, but they hoped to get
it. Was supposedly a retroactive clause that she remembers. She's very hazy on the legal battles going on, but a retroactive clause that stipulated that if the city did not clean the canals, that
they would revert to the Kinney Company.
That the Kinney Company, the land would then go back, that the...
Did you ever try to exercise that?
No.
No.
There's also something else which is rumored, and I dare say there's some truth in it. A.S. Roberts mentioned it, as a matter of fact, in one of his speech not long ago, that the articles incorporating the city of Venice into the city of Los Angeles stipulated that all the buildings then standing and in existence at that time would be subject only to the old building laws of the time that they were built, and that there would be no penalties attached to, or no, there would be no requirement for bringing them in line with the municipal building code of the city of Los Angeles. And this has been violated over and over again.
Oh, certainly. Well, that's the big controversy today.
Yes. Now, as to whether this is so, whether this is really incorporated, curiously enough, the people I know who have tried to get copies of the original contract or agreement or whatever it is that they do from the city have been given a runaround, have been told they must wait, and in one case I know a man was told that no copy exists, that some other unexplainable reason, no copy exists. We inquire about that from the city of Los Angeles. The records department, the Hall of Records.
Well, the Kinneys have it.
Hall of Records.
They could get a hold of it.
Well, the Kinneys probably would know. You might ask her if she has a phone number. Ask her if she ever attempted to get.
She never did. She told us.
She never attempted.
But see, Thornton, her son.
Her brother.
Excuse me. has records. Very interesting because Thornton had a piece of property when the oil was.
That was Carlton.
Carlton. So all these brothers ran the company, and they have the contract. She's got documents stuffed away in their old home. They live in a boat. They sold their home, and they store their materials.
They live in a boat? That's where they live.
That's where they live, on a boat.
They live on a boat.
Well, her husband's an engineer at Douglas Aircraft Corporation.
I see.
An old-time engineer. Very interesting. The woman is...
What is her name?
Helen Ward.
Helen Ward.
Yeah.
Very interesting. It might be interesting to find out whether or not there really was such a stipulation in the original agreement, because if there was, and it could be found and it could be used as a basis for suit, a lot of
she was talking
homeowners, property owners have a legitimate suit against the city, including the owner of the gas house.
She was talking about, there was something else you mentioned too. She was going to check, what was it? She was going to check with the city on a recent happening.
Yeah, what did she bring up?
Oh, they donated.
Oh, that's right.
They donated around 600 acres on the Palisades.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kinney, Abbott Kinney, had a fixation about a eucalyptus, one of his, not a fixation, an interest in eucalyptus trees.
And wildflowers, both.
Oh, and many things, procreation, the whole bit. But he donated 600 acres.
No,
to
it wasn't
USC.
That much, Tony, in the Palisades. It was.
Well,
that.
In any case, he donated a number of acres, and with a stipulation that SC was not supposed to sell. Recently, she was up there, and it's been subdivided. But she's not an aggressive woman. She said that she thought she might call SC, you know.
Yeah.
Sure, and.
Well, for goodness sake, you did get help for that. Sit down with that. I wondered if you'd get help for carrying that.
Yeah.
I would have helped too.
Izzy, you're Izzy.
How are you?
Is
it all in there?
No,
oh, okay, wait a minute. Pop the door open for him there. Yes, go ahead.
Well, this is one issue they know of. They have felt her husband, Helen's husband, helped run the Kinney Company.
He sat on the board of directors. She's the kind of woman who, she has an image of herself as a romantic in the same way that her father was. And she shuns away from business or any actual connection.
She had the books. When the company went down, they were on a business trip. And
They went to Wichita.
Well, they were there when they got word of the company. But they, boy, anyone who does some digging, which I'm thinking of doing actually, I think this would make...
What is your major?
Well, I'm out of school now. I was dramatic.
Digging or digging?
Well, digging into, I feel that there wouldn't be much, readership perhaps, but there would be tremendous history could be written, because this is unique in American history. This city is unique. You see, there is no real remnant of Venice today as it was. This man, Ward, who sat on the board, said, there's nothing, and this is a city that has disappeared virtually. But it was so...
It had a glory.
Thing about it that is incredible. And these people have escaped the reality of what has happened. They have not returned. They have lost all interest. And the man who founded this, her father, it was such a vibrant man. And the whole emotion that is connected with this is fascinating. It's a very specialized piece of work, but I think it could be done and probably would interest some of these Americana publishers. But I think that I will continue it. It's a real, there's a many scandals connected to Denton, who weren't supposed to mention this.
That's not his name.
Wasn't it Denton?
No, I have it in my notes. It's
one of the top politicians of the day was the one who engineered a blackmail. His daughter had won the Nobel Prize for Literature during this time.
Or his sister. His sister.
And this is fascinating stuff.
His name, what's the man's name?
Something,
Newton.
Newton.
Al Newton. And Al
big
Newton
politician.
He was a big laureate.
His sister won a Nobel Prize.
His sister won a Nobel Prize.
Not an American Nobel Prize.
That's not her name.
No, but no woman has ever won a Nobel Prize for literature.
They weren't sure if it was Nobel or Pulitzer or what.
They weren't sure.
Could have been a Pulitzer.
I said Pulitzer, they said yes.
Please come in.
I said Nobel, they said that's it. So it wasn't clear.
Yeah.
You should have tried booby.
They probably would have said yes.
Hi, Antonio. Archer Goodwin.
Hi.
This is Darlene Castle.
My wife, Millie.
Hi.
Millie?
Yes.
Millie?
What's
the name? Millie. Now, let's hold it for a minute until I get reorganized again, shall we? Just a moment.
Shall we
get
your coffee, or would you like to have
it? 7-Up or tea, or?
Tea story. Yes. Well, when I first came to live in Los Angeles, I was given to understand that the place to live was in the Silver Lake area. And I found other people who lived there, and others who came from the same Bohemia I came from in Chicago, went to live there. Among them, Engstrand, who wrote the book he's best known for, there would be Beyond the Forest, wouldn't it? He published a number of novels, which were Betty Davis made into a movie. She wrote Miss Monday, which is well known as a bestseller in his time, his wife, schoolteacher life. Well, anyway, this was an earlier Bohemia here. The painters began to come here in the late 30s. And by the 40s, a number of painters, as I've told you before, are already established here. You haven't called up or talked with them.
No, I'm not going to have time to really go into it again until Christmas.
Oh, very good. What do you do?
Yeah.
Talk to the people I told you about.
2 weeks, yeah.
That's right. And the Albrights came and lived here too for a short time. They were brought out by Hollywood though. Ivan Albright is a famous name in painting. I don't know how well you know painting if you're acquainted with it.
Well, quite. Now, so
there still are in the Silver Lake area poets, painters, musicians who regard that as the authentic Bohemia of Los Angeles and look upon Venice as upstart and contemptible. In fact, at one time they conducted a veritable vendetta against me in a magazine which they published called Coastlines Magazine, in which they called me the Merchant of Venice, and in which they had several lead articles, you know, of the most venomous kind, because they said on one occasion I was told by the editors of this magazine that I had invented the Venice art movement, that it didn't exist, that these people were inventions of mine, and that I had perpetrated a hoax. In fact, the magazine, and that cry was taken up by other magazines, so that it found its way, in a way of speaking, it found its way into this book, Social Disorganization in America, by Reese McGee, University of Texas. It was quoting at great length to bolster his argument and to support his thesis. He quotes from the Holy Barbarians at considerable length. But first, being a professor and careful to hedge a little on his authorities, he protects himself with a footnote, which I think you'll find amusing. I think I can find it here. Yes, in his first mention, he says, one of the few extended studies yet made of the beats and being beat is Lawrence Lipton's The Holy Barbarians. This informative and entertaining book has enjoyed considerable popularity. Footnote. There may be reason to suspect that Lipton's book is an elaborate gag that he is more interested in bugging the squares than in accurate reporting, but it is ostensibly proffered as a serious description and explanation of the Beat Generation, and for the purposes of this analysis is accepted at face value. Now, he spoke of it there as a way of bugging the squares, you know, a pâté de bourgeois, you know? But I suspect that one of his sources for this suspicion was the Coastlines article. And I know it must have been widely read, because it was read even by Edgar Hoover, who, I think it was in that magazine, he read my poem, I Was a Poet for the FBI, on the occasion, you know, when he sent investigators to ask me, to investigate me and find out if I really was a poet for the FBI, and accused me of impersonating an officer of the Department of Justice.
Well, anyway, so
here it is, you see. Here, too, you have this, you see, that it's a gag, that it can't be so, that it's just not so, it's made up. Now, you know, Rexroth found the same kind of suspicion when he first spoke of the Renaissance of Literature in San Francisco. They said that he had at least exaggerated, if not made up on whole cloth, the story of these unpublished authors, poets, writers, novelists, whose works didn't exist. When it was first mentioned by myself and others, that Kerouac had several books, unpublished books, you know, many people in articles wrote to the effect that this was an apocryphal tale, or at best only a kind of pious fraud, and that by his friends, perpetrated by his friends on an innocent public, that these books never existed, that they don't. And it was, to everyone's great surprise, one after another was published, you know, and it really did exist. And Ginsberg had assured me, although I'd never seen him, I had been assured by him that he had seen these works and read them. You see. But again, about this business of the...
You, Tommy, do you have some tea? You, honey?
Yes, if you will. But I was, if the other kind, you know.
What do you think of Kerouac's work?
I'm on record in The Holy Barbarians about it. I've had different things to say about different books, and only recently reviewed his latest, Big Sur, in the Los Angeles Times. So you missed that, perhaps?
Yeah, I didn't see. I don't read the Times.
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of principle that you don't read the Times, but well, there are people who, on principle, do not read the Times.
No,
I don't read the Times either.
Yeah. Well, you don't read any papers, as far as I can see, do you?
Yes, oh, yes, I do.
The New York Times?
The New York Times.
In
Chicago, I read all the newspapers. In New York, I narrowed it down to three. When I got to Los Angeles, I tried a couple of them, but I gave up.
Well, you shouldn't have let your eye stray to the editorial department, you see. You should have kept it.
Well, that was the problem. I couldn't find any.
You can't get past the front page.
I assure you that Prescott of the Times has nothing that Bob Kirsch hasn't got in the way of acumen and so forth.
Well, I found the Los Angeles Times, right, these sort of like small town papers, you know. There's a lot on the front page about some lady whose dog was stolen over Silver Lake, and somebody who was kidnapped by her boyfriend, and some Mexicans who were squatting on the airstrip or something, but there was nothing about what was going on in the world at all, you know?
Well,
everything was going on in Torrance, and nothing about...
I always got the idea on international...
I'll let you know the secret, in case you promise not to take it ill.
What did you say about Kerouac?
A moment, let you know the secret. It was all there. Everything that was in the New York Times was in the LA Times. The New York LA Times had all the services of the New York Times News Bureau and its features, and was in there. But you know why you didn't see them in the LA Times? Because they were buried in a million pages of ads.
Women's fashions.
Yes. Yeah. They were buried there, and you didn't see them. You would be astonished if you went back over copies of the LA Times and found all these things there which you didn't even turn the page to, you know?
We like to read the paper with a magnifying glass, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. Well, there should be a shortened version of it. It is getting better.
Just in the recent...
Well, it has to be because of the Times, you know? The New York Times competition now. Well, anyway, I just want to...
I read it every now and then through those plastic boxes which they have on the street corner. I stop and get down on my knees and read the Los Angeles Times. but I won't give my time.
That's what I mean by principle.
That's what I thought you meant.
I steal it.
You
I
steal it,
and
yeah.
I won't pay for it. I will put it back after I finish it.
Thank you.
You're really an honest person at heart, aren't you?
This is like Russian tea.
This is a very largely a political attitude, I thought, because the same reason the people in Chicago was not read the Chicago Tribune. The Tribune, as a matter of fact, was, from the standpoint of news, one of the best newspapers in America. But its editorial policy was reactionary. And a good many people on principle would not read it. I knew people that destroyed copies whenever they could lay their hands on them.
Well,
people
Tribune
of the new dealers, and those of the...
The Chicago American.
Left of center people did do this, actually destroyed copies of the Chicago Tribune. And the same attitude was, I found here when I came here. I found it was already in 1941, when I first came here, that there were people who would not touch a copy of the Times with a 10-foot pole. And on principle, avoided it, would not pay for it. And they were the people who laid down their nickels for the, it was a nickel in those days, for the news, for the Los Angeles News, you haven't heard of it.
The Daily News.
Yeah. Which was run by a man, who remembers his name now, such as fame. He had a fancy name, but I forgot what it was. But anyway, he was described by his employees as a man who led many a good cause, dash, up a blind alley and clubbed it to death. I used that line in a poem which I wrote called End of the Line, remember? Yeah. So,
the thing I liked about the Chicago Tribune was its modesty, you know, on their masthead, an American flag with the world's greatest newspaper.
Yeah, but that alone was enough
to alienate
anybody with any sense of proportion or any sense of...
I took it, though. I was very amused by a remark at one time by, they had called the University of Illinois, one of the worst universities in the country, and somebody answered from the University of Illinois, yeah. And a little thing saying that we can't, judging by their, or, their judgment of newspapers, then we can't take this very seriously, you know,
yeah.
This is a little answer. Very funny.
Now, this, the Saturday, what was Saturday night, was that the name of the newspaper?
No, the Saturday Post.
Post, a weekly paper.
The only place you can get it, actually, is at the Los Angeles Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Kinneys have it, but,
They have it stowed away.
I was eating lunch in a Chinese restaurant today. And I noticed that the Chinese waiter, who can't speak English very well, and he speaks Cantonese Chinese, he was reading a newspaper. So I looked to see what the Chinese newspaper was in town, and he was reading the Banai Brit Messenger. I couldn't quite figure it out.
That'd be the
convert. Because in Hebrew, we like the fashion and the letter.
Hey, you know, lucky Jewish.
That's funny.
Well, it's a Jewish newspaper. It's published in English, of course.
Yeah.
We noticed that.
Yeah.
Returning to Venice. Now, after, let's pick up where we left off, Shelley, at the last. Was there anything in your notes did you reread your notes, and did any questions occur to you?
The only thing that did occur to me is we started to talk about the Brotherhood of Holy Barbarians.
Oh, yes.
And then we got off the track.
I said I'll take it up next time because I was busy that night. All right, well, the Brotherhood of Holy Barbarians was started by Fuad Magdalena.
Oh, I've seen his name.
Well, a picture is not being made.
Oh, that's
motion
the one
being made, Chaz is making of his life. Fuad Magdalani.
Magdalani
is the correct pronunciation. Now, he was he was one of the first people to occupy the Grand Hotel on Market Street.
I graduated.
And which became the Hotel of the Holy Barbarians.
As I told you, I just read one short little slip in the newspaper, which told, I think it was brought out during the hearing, that you were going to start.
The people who occupied it, all together about 25 people, each one had a separate room. And every room was decorated according to the tastes of the person who occupied it. The walls.
Are you at the Warner Brothers?
Yeah. Will you hold it just a little bit?
Right, yeah.
Because I'm recording this and I don't want to be lost up the tape. The walls of each room were decorated with abstract paintings. And sometimes, occasionally, representational figures with slogans, poems, quotations from poems. The wall, the floors were painted. Every square inch, including the toilet seats, were covered with color, in the tradition of the Impressionist painters, who did precisely the same sort of thing in Brittany. When they went there in the following the example of Paul Gauguin, and then which Paul Gauguin did also in Tahiti, and I dare say in Paris, although that we don't know, nothing has survived of his Paris studio, but but according to his own account and certain eyewitnesses. He decorated his home that way. Not a single square inch would be left.
How did the owner of the hotel feel about this?
The owner of the hotel was in a constant state of ulcers. he stormed and he ranted. After all, he had only leased his property, you know. And he said, "What am I going to do after these people leave?
To a gallery."
And of course, this is a problem that many a landlord in Venice had too. After once any one of the beats had moved in and decorated the place, he couldn't rent it to anybody but a beat. And that meant that he would have an endless succession of dead beats on his hands who never paid any rent. Or maybe the first month would be about all. And then it was a case of.
So are you saying the beats are dead beats?
Me. Oh yes.
The only good beat is a dead beat.
That's a good quote.
It is part of the mystique of the beat, if you care to quote me, and I have no objection to it, that the business civilization is a fraud, and it is fair game for any disaffiliate or alienated person, artist or no artist, to beat the landlord out of his rent, cheat the utilities companies out of payment, and the installment houses out of installments, and the finance company out of payments. I say each one of these. No examples of it. And even the telephone company. Oh, particularly the telephone.
The last story I heard was where this girl I knew who had a telephone listed under the name of the cat.
Yeah, she had so many telephones yanked out from under her, so to speak, you know, that she had run out of names of people that she could, in whose name she could reopen her telephone account. She finally decided to open it in the name of the cat, of the family cat. And it was listed in San Francisco, wasn't it? It was listed in the name of the cat. Yeah.
Now, yeah, Chevrolet.
So, in other words, it was a war. It was a kind of underground operation, guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla warfare between the beat world and the square world. that went on, particularly the business civilization.
About how many people were there? You mentioned the 25
grand. Well, that was all that we could put in there. There were.
But
there
about
was
how
more.
Many? Around 59. How many people were there
this
down
is,
here who called themselves
constantly
beef?
Asked me that question. They asked me this and
nobody
that.
Nobody calls themselves.
Nobody.
Beef.
All right. Who? Everyone else called themselves.
If you ask me, I can tell you that beginning with a nucleus of six or seven,
yeah,
it had grown over 2 or 3 years since 57, let's say, 56.
56.
56. Beginning with a nucleus of six or seven, it had grown by 1958, short, when I was writing the Holy Barbarians, to a group probably of, say, family, including families and artists and their friends, and the political leftists started coming in too. I'd say scattered over this entire community, maybe 500. That's the figure I usually gave at that time. I would vary it sometimes between 400 and 500. I could only estimate it. I didn't know everybody. Nobody ever made a census.
It's hard to get a
picture.
But
I'll tell you how I know.
Everybody.
My mailing list, finally, when it was obtained from the gas house, had a mailing list of people living in the area. And my mailing list of people living in the area, supporting the gas house, paying contributions to it from time to time, coming to all our affairs, and who express themselves as being bohemians and beat, numbered about 500, based upon a mailing list, you can say that.
Actually, when Jonathan Williams came through and Larry, and it got so that we couldn't have any more poetry readings in the house.
It's too big.
Because there was too many people came. You couldn't sit, you know.
They had to rent a hall.
And we rented a hall, and the halls were jammed.
Yes.
The hall seated about 100. We thought maybe it'd be 100 people, and we were just.
We found it about 200.
And then they had to read
to the landlord's consternation. But anyway, about 500. Mm-hmm. Now, this grew to the point where thousands flocked in from all over. I now, as to the number, I would say it would not be an exaggeration to say the number of people came from all over the world, from the United States and from all over the world, to view the Venice after the publication of the Holy Barbarians is at least 500,000. And they actually supported, these tourists actually supported several bookstores and
A lot of these people were curiosity seekers, weren't they?
Yeah. There were people who were curiosity
curious.
Seekers.
Yeah.
They were of all sorts. There were people who were, well, if you read the letters which I received from many of these people before they came here, you would see that there were people hungry for avant-garde arts and nonconformism and sexual freedom and so forth.
I read one very interesting story.
That's where they came from.
I think it was in Life magazine, about how some high school girls in the Midwest asked, they didn't know what a BBQ was, and they invited you to come and speak at their high school, and there was civic uproar.
There was. The girls, for your information, were spirited out of town. I learned this.
Yes, this was in the article.
They were spirited out of town.
This was part of the article.
And so that they would not be there. They invited me, as a matter of fact, to their annual prom.
Spring City. Prom. She was
a prom.
Were you the queen?
And I was
to administer the Dionysian rite.
It was a between. It was.
That would make a terrific film.
Wouldn't it?
Did you ever see that issue of Life magazine?
Oh, yeah. Was that funny? They had pictures. The typical big cat and the typical small town in the Midwest. And it's just the most wonderful article.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, anyway. This happened, and a lot of things like it happened, too. Some never gelled at all. I would get telephone calls, frantic telephone calls from all over the country, saying I'm 21 years old, and we are sitting here together, and we decided that you should come to have poetry and jazz. Bring your whole gang with you. Bring your band with you. We want to have... And I'd say, well, all fine, okay. Well, when? And they'd give me a date. They'd say, well, we'll let you know about the date. And I would get a date. I would get a letter afterwards, very sad, saying that the principal of the school beat on it, and our parents have told us that things like this would happen all the time. Or I'd get letters from a young lady in Pittsburgh saying, my mother and father don't know I'm writing this letter. Please put an ad in the Pittsburgh Press in the personal saying, yes, come to Venice. You know? So such things as this. I got hundreds of letters.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's funny.
Yeah.
You should write a book just about these.
About the letters? Yeah, they're probably going to make an interesting book. Well, anyway, I'm saving them for something. I don't know what.
Jesus, she's probably still looking at the classifieds.
I was very sad, but I never answered those letters. Because
well,
I knew
you needed a
publicity man.
I was accused of being one. Many people thought that I invented this whole thing just for publicity, you know, and that I instigated all of these letters and all sort of things. You know, nothing of the sort is true. As a matter of fact, I didn't even take advantage of it. I did not hurry to press to write a sequel, which of course would have been good business. I did nothing at all.
The magazines would send him copies, you know, issues in which they were discussing the beat and ask for comment, and he wouldn't even answer them because he just didn't, you know.
Well, I figured if anything I had to say, I'd write my own essays. I don't want to enter into controversy with people who are obviously have evil intentions about it, who are baiting me. You know?
Voyeuristic society, they were all looking through the keyhole and evil vintage.
Yeah. So, these are one of the things that happened, but about the hotel for only by bearings. Now, Al Matthews footed the bill for the rent, and also he fed the multitudes with fishes and loaves.
Sometimes they had 100 people there for dinner.
Yeah, sometimes there's 100 people would eat there from outside, so anyone who was hungry could come and eat. And they didn't have to be artists, they needed to be just bohemians or anybody that was. Well, and as a matter of fact, among those 100 are probably a few boys on the land, some kids that run away from home.
Yeah.
It was like a rescue mission.
It was a rescue mission.
It was exactly like
from
that.
Squaresville. Refugees from Squaresville.
Did you give them the Beat Manifesto?
It was a camp. It was a camp. It was a kind of a Red Cross camp for the refugees from Squaresville. And among them were refugee sons of very distinguished people, you know, who at first tried to come in incognito, you know. Sometimes they'd let a few of us in on the secret. Some were men who had run away from their wives and were alimony refugees.
All those people going to Peace Corps now.
The Peace Corps.
Street.
No, they won't take you to Peace Corps.
No.
Yeah, no,
they
can't
accept
your
speech. They want to know everything you ever did in your life.
Amazing. Now they're
clearing you
for purity. I think
you probably
have to account
for every hour of the day and every day of the week and from the time you were born.
Yeah,
just so I don't send postcards.
Yeah, the screening for... there was no screening.
Good point.
We didn't know. There was no screening here.
You didn't make the security clearance.
Everybody was just as welcome as at the Feast of Jesus in Galilee, and we sent out into the streets and asked the poor and the halt and the lame and the blind.
How long did this last?
The hotel lasted for about 6 months, and every month I had to fight with the landlord of the hotel on the one hand, who said that we were ruining his place, and on the other hand, with the sponsor, who was scared to death that somebody was going to get arrested there or busted for narcotics or for alcoholism, and that it would reflect upon his reputation as a lawyer, and so it was a tussle to get the rent out of him every month, on the one hand, the landlord on the other, and then pretty soon the narcos were around every day looking for kits, you know, and for horse, and for marijuana. And it got to be an impossible situation. I must also report, for the benefit of the record, that artists who are emblematic, symptomatic of the decay of a society, are not usually given to orderliness in their personal habits. So that on almost every morning of the week, empty wine bottles would litter the halls, half-eaten sandwiches, food carried over from the gas house, and they would pile up on the floor and overflow the garbage cans and the trash cans, and it was next to impossible to get any of them to give any labor. The arrangement was that, like in the ancient monasteries, or modern monasteries for that matter, that as in the monastic orders, each was to give a portion of his time for work to keep the place clean, to police it, you know, by all their own policing arrangements. But in actual practice, it did not work out. The person who was in charge of it, if one of them wasn't put in charge of it, he was at once the enemy. The silence of authority. He was the state, and he was the heat. It made no difference, he could have been the most beloved of them, you know. But the minute that he was appointed, because I was appointed to pass upon the eligibility of, since we couldn't admit everybody, I tried to admit those with major talent, what I considered major talent. And I did succeed. Bringing that was the that place among the what ultimately became perhaps 30 or 40. You say, I see, I admitted 25 or 30, that's all the rooms there were. But each of them admitted their own, all their friends and girlfriends, with the result that as many as 100 people in there at one time, you see. And not only that, they kept the rooms, the beds hot. Those whom they pitied, because they were out on the street, usually Negro bongo players and Negro musicians, you know, jazz musicians, they, when they got up in the morning, a new shift went in and slept for a few hours. Then they got up and they gave up their beds to a new shift that slept for a few hours. And so they kept the beds hot like in Skid Row, you know? It's like in Skid Row, 24 hours a day. And of course there was feasting in the halls and wine and parties every night up on the roof.
And the bongos.
Are they doing any work?
Yes. The work is to be had. If you don't believe they did any work, I have some of it here. Come over here and I'll prove it to you. Come on.
Oh, I believe you.
Yeah, we're just curious.
This is only a little bit of it, which I have to...